Hello and welcome to the InFocus podcast. This is G. Sampath, your host for today's episode. Earlier this week, the Joint Parliamentary Committee on the Personal Data Protection Bill 2019, or the PDP bill, adopted the final draft of the bill, which is set to be tabled in the winter session of Parliament. India right now doesn't really have a data protection regime, and this legislation will lay the foundation for protection of an individual's privacy in the digital age in India. The bill is also of great importance for corporates, both Indian firms as well as foreign ones that operate in India and process the data of Indians, as they will have to bear the cost of complying with the data protection regulations. Another big stakeholder is the government of India itself. In India, along with the private sector, the state itself has been a keen player in the data game through a multitude of policy measures, of which the most well-known is Aadhaar. It has been collecting and hoarding huge quantities of data with very little accountability. So there are a lot of expectations riding on a robust data protection regime, which should ideally be on a par with the international gold standard, as it were, in data protection, such as Europe's General Data Protection Regulation, or GDPR, as it's known. So how robust is India's PDP bill, and how will its provisions as they stand in the current draft affect us? For a clearer picture on what this bill has in store, we have with us Delhi-based advocate Kritika Bhardwaj. Kritika is a fellow with the Center for Communication Governance at the National Law University, Delhi, and writes frequently on privacy and data protection issues. Kritika, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kritika, to start with, can you give us a quick overview of the main features of the Personal Data Protection Bill 2019 that is to be tabled in the coming session of Parliament?
So essentially, the bill is intended to regulate the collection and use of personal data. When we say personal data, we mean data that is relates to a natural person, or data that renders a person identifiable. So the whole intention was to address this indiscriminate and ubiquitous use of personal data which is being collected equally by private as well as state entities. So for example, if your bank has your financial data as well as other personal data, because you open an account with them, it should not be that the bank is able to profit from this data by selling it off to a third party, because that's not the reason for which you shared this data with your bank, right? And so that is the underlying objective of the bill, and that's what it aims to address. I think if I were to give a very, very broad overview, the bill has basically, to my mind, four main features. It sort of lays down certain principles for data protection. So, for example, it mandates that only data which is essential for a particular purpose must be collected. Once it's collected, it must be used for that limited purpose and not recycled or repurposed. Once there is no longer a need for that data to be retained, it must be deleted. I'm just naming a few, but essentially that, you know, it lays down certain data protection principles. The second limb the second main feature of the bill would be certain grounds. It lays down grounds for processing or collection or use of personal data. So when we talk of grounds, it must be that this collection or use of data by an entity must be based on free and informed consent, or there are exceptions to this, for example, for the performance of a legal obligation, so on and so forth. The third, I think, main feature of the bill would be that it confers certain important rights. It confers individuals with certain important rights, the right to review their data, the right to access their data, to seek correction of that data if it's inaccurate, and the right to even seek erasure or deletion of that data under certain circumstances. And I think what ties all of these three limbs or three main features together is that the bill also proposes a data protection authority, which is intended to be sort of a centralized regulator which oversees compliance with the Act. So I think that's the overall sort of framework of the bill, and that's how it intends to operate.
Okay, that adds, I think, a tremendous amount of clarity to the entire debate around this bill. You've really outlined it very well, the principles of the bill and the grounds through which you get into this whole data processing business, and then the rights, and finally data protection authority. I think that's a very good overview. Now, going to the process and the timeline in terms of the evolution of the bill, one of the key developments has been the fact that it was referred to a joint parliamentary committee, which has studied the bill for a long time. So can you talk a little bit about why this was constituted, what it did, and what have been the impact following the adoption of the final draft that it has done?
I think so. There is, of course, a tremendous history to the data protection bill, which initially there was a committee of experts appointed in 2018 under the chairmanship of retired Justice Sri Krishna. They came up with a report as well as a draft bill. This was in 2018. But the government sort of built on that report and that draft bill and came out with its own version of the bill sometime in 2019. But just given the sort of wide-ranging or significant impact that this bill was likely to have across industries, I think you mentioned this even in your introduction, I think it was sort of felt imperative that this be referred to a joint parliamentary committee. So in December 29, the government's version of the bill, the 2019 draft bill, was referred to a joint parliamentary committee, which consisted of, I think, 30 members of parliament across party lines. The committee, of course, has deliberated over 2 years, as we've seen, because the report has only been finalized in towards the end of 2021. I think some of the consultations and the work of the committee was, of course, impacted by COVID. But and we've seen that even in the dissent notes, some of the members have challenged the process by which the committee functioned. But just to give the listeners an overview, that's been the sort of trajectory or timeline, and that's how we've reached this joint parliamentary committee report. And now, as you mentioned, the bill is likely to be tabled in the upcoming parliament session.
I was just going to ask you to elaborate on the dissent note that you just referred to.
Yeah, right. So yeah, just to give a little bit of an overview, I think some of the actually, I can address the recommendations and the dissent notes collectively. So I think the committee has made some important interventions and recommendations. What is equally important or significant are the lack of recommendations actually from the Joint Parliamentary Committee. For example, the 2019 draft bill had a very, very widely drafted exemption clause for the government. So basically, this clause allowed the central government to exempt any state entity or any state agencies from obligations, any and all obligations under the bill. And so this was one of the most heavily criticized clauses under the bill. And it was expected that the JPC, the Joint Parliamentary Committee, would recommend some safeguards or put in some limitations to this widely drafted exemption clause.
Is this the Section 35 that everybody is talking about?
Yes, this is the Clause 35 that everyone's talking about. And in fact, it has been heavily referenced in almost all of the dissent notes. And that seems to be one of the main grounds of dissent by all of the dissenting members. So it is quite surprising that, the committee didn't think that this merited further safeguards or procedural safeguards. And in fact, if the clause is accepted as it is, or if the bill is passed in its certain in this form, it does. There is a huge risk that the law will be rendered quite toothless as far as the government's use of personal data is concerned, or the citizens' right to privacy against the state is concerned. And I think there are, of course, the committee has made certain positive recommendations too. For example, they have recommended that In the event of a data breach, the reporting mechanism has been strengthened. They've put in some express timelines within which the data breach must be reported. For data protection officers, which are appointed by companies collecting and using data, they have made a recommendation that senior management personnel be appointed to these positions so that these complaints are dealt with more seriously and in a stricter way. So, of course, some recommendations are welcome, but some of these recommendations, for example, the committee's failure to engage with Clause 35 and Clause 12 are quite problematic. Just again, to give an overview, Clause 12 is, we discussed earlier that one of the main grounds for processing of data under the bill is that it must be subject to free and informed consent. There are, of course, certain exceptions to consent. For example, when you need to process data in compliance with a legal obligation, or for the purposes of employment or social security, or for the purposes of maybe if it's pursuant to a court order or a, you know, judgment. But one of these exceptions, which is extremely widely worded, is that if the government is offering a service or a benefit, or if it is issuing a certification or a license or some permit, then the government doesn't need to take your consent. On the face of it, I think this might appear reasonable, because if I am, for example, if I go to a fair price shop and claim a certain PDS grain, I might be required to show a ration card, because the ration card determines my entitlement to that subsidized PDS grain. But what this clause does is, I mean, it might be legitimate for the government to ask for maybe a ration card, but is it legitimate or proportionate or necessary for the government to even seek biometric authentication before it can issue me this PDS grain? Is a question which I think Clause 12 makes it harder to challenge. It sort of flips the onus onto the individuals to show that something is not proportionate or necessary. So it just, I think, instead of the state having to justify or to show why a certain, or why access or collection of certain personal data should be allowed, it sort of begins with the presumption that this data is necessary and is legally supposed to be or can be collected. And for the individual to then try and, you know, through judicial means, try and challenge this requirement. So I think it's quite concerning that the committee didn't engage with this consent requirement under Clause 12 and the exemption under Clause 35 when it finalized its report.
Right. But in this context, I was just wondering, when earlier on you outlined the broad principles which the law lays down for data protection, which are explicitly sort of stated. Now, do you think, is there an underlying assumption which is not explicitly stated, but sort of implicitly animates the entire bill, which is that a government by definition is above suspicion when it comes to data collection processing, because it always and necessarily acts only in public interest, and therefore it is automatically exempt from being subject to the same kind of rigorous regulation that the private sector might be expected to follow.
Correct. You're absolutely right. And I think that's coming out from the draft and now even from the report of the Joint Parliamentary Committee. But I think this assumption is not something that we can or should accept, right? I think there is an equal danger of surveillance or privacy risks from the state, if not greater, in fact. And this is not something that if you compare the draft bill with contemporary data protection legislations across the world, these sort of widely worded and blanket exemptions I have not seen in any other data protection legislation. And so usually, of course, the state has certain legitimate interests when it comes to investigation of criminal offenses or even for providing services. But these exceptions must be very, very narrowly tailored, must be proportionate. And the onus must be on the state to justify why in a particular circumstance it requires access to certain data, rather than for the individual or rather for the state to say that unless challenged and unless set aside by a court, this is all acceptable and this is all permissible.
Right. Now, moving on to some specific aspects of the bill. I mean, one of the things that have also figured in the debate is the bill's classification of data into personal data and sensitive personal data. So what are the implications of this classification?
I think so. The classification is premised on an idea that there are certain risks or higher risks associated with disclosure of certain kinds of data. For example, financial information or information about sexual orientation or caste or health data, if it is wrongfully disclosed or transferred, results to a higher harm as compared to maybe other categories of data. So this classification is carved out under the bill, but the current text of the draft of the bill, at least the 2019 bill, which was referred to the Joint Parliamentary Committee, did not sort of lay out any specific limitations or additional obligations with respect to sensitive personal data. There were very, very limited sort of restrictions in terms of when it can be transferred, and ordinarily that it is required to be stored in India unless there is express consent for its transfer. So, of course, in theory, the classification makes sense. And it also makes sense to impose higher obligations or a higher burden on entities which are dealing with this kind of data. So, for example, hospitals or banks and so on and so forth. But in the current text of the bill, we don't really know what is the extent of these higher obligations. The bill sort of relegates this to its rulemaking power or delegated legislation. So we're only likely to see this once rules are framed under the Act.
Okay, because I asked because there seem to be some fears in certain quarters that the classification or the creation of this category of sensitive personal data in a way sort of liberates data classified as personal data from the same level of rigorous data protection that would otherwise be applicable to all personal data. You know, like now you have two different layers or two different categories, which sort of makes the primary category sort of less important in terms of protection.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that hasn't been my reading of the bill, in the sense that I think the principles and the grounds which have been provided for under the law are quite significant and substantial and comparable with international standards. Of course, there are certain significant problems in the bill, which, you know, as we discussed, Clause 12, Clause 35. But the idea, I think what it does, so, and the bill has certain sort of optional obligations, not optional, but certain additional obligations for example, a privacy impact assessment or an independent audit, a data audit. And these are the sort of higher obligations that the bill contemplates. It is possible that under the rules, then certain sort of entities which deal with sensitive personal data might be asked to comply with these additional obligations.
Right. So coming to the actual processing of data, how does the bill approach consent and processing of data, and how is the data protection authority as envisioned by the bill likely to sort of do its job? Is it adequately empowered? Is it independent enough in terms of the rules and regulation that would apply for appointments and tenure and so on?
If I deal with consent first, I think the language or of the clause under the bill for consent is there is a lot of emphasis under the bill on free and informed consent. And the bill goes as far as to say that, you know, the consent must be specific for that purpose for which you need data. And it must also be capable of being withdrawn with relative ease. So the ease with which you give consent, it should be as easy to revoke consent. However, of course, I mean, consent, as we've discussed, is not the only ground on which data can be processed or used. There are other additional grounds. Some of them appear to be quite legitimate. For example, when data is required to be processed for a legal obligation, for a medical emergency, for employment-related purposes. But of course, as we've discussed, Clause 12, which is the government's use of data without consent, these appear to be very, very broadly or widely worded, which does sort of create some risk of misuse. And then I think coming to the second part of your question, which was about the data protection authority and the independence of the authority, I wanted to take a step back and maybe discuss how this process has evolved over the last 4 or 5 years. So when the initial draft of the Shri Krishna Committee bill was released, we saw that for appointment of, you know, members of the data protection authority, the expert committee or the Shri Krishna Committee had recommended a committee comprising of members from the judiciary, an expert member, as well as some representation from the executive. When we saw the 2019 bill released by the government, we saw that this appointment committee comprised solely of members from the executive. So in that sense, this, of course, the appointment process is now controlled entirely by the executive, which does create some cloud or some doubt over the independence of the authority. And this is quite important because, I mean, notwithstanding the wide exemptions that the law has carved out, the Data Protection Authority is also tasked with looking at the government's compliance with the law. So if the if the appointment process is so heavily controlled by the government, it of course creates some risk or some doubt about whether or not the authority will be able to exercise its functions independently again when the government is alleged to have breached or violated some part of the law. Another sort of concern which comes to mind when we talk about independence of the authority is the 2019 draft bill had a clause that when it comes to questions of policy, the central government can issue certain binding directions on the authority. I think this in itself was a little problematic, but surprisingly, what the Joint Parliamentary Committee report has recommended is that not just on questions of policy, but on all and any issues, and we don't know how this will come out in practice, but on all issues, the authority is bound by directions of the central government. So I think to some extent, this defeats the purpose of setting up an independent regulator, who is also, again, to emphasize, looking at violations or compliance of the act by the state itself.
Right. Again, staying on this, on an issue related to the mandate of the Data Protection Authority, which is grievance redressal. Under the bill, one of the things the bill does is that it amends the Information Technology Act 2000 to delete the provisions related to compensation payable by companies for failure to protect personal data. So why was this necessary? I mean, is there something against compensation being paid? And are there other avenues available to an ordinary citizen for who has a grievance and wants A, the grievance to be redressed, and B, if required, seek compensation?
Yeah, so I think I'll maybe address the second part of your question first, which is about the repeal of the compensation section under the IT Act. I think in my mind that deletion or repeal was necessary. Section 43A under the IT Act was quite a poorly drafted and a very sort of inadequate mechanism for data protection, and rarely ever enforced, to be honest. What the draft bill does is it sets out a very sort of comprehensive regime for compensation. And this compensation is then determined on the basis of the nature of the violation, the duration for which it continued, the extent of harm caused as a result of it, whether it was intentional, what actions were taken to mitigate it, what has been the historical conduct of the entity. So there is now, I think, a proper mechanism and quantification also of what compensation an aggrieved individual might be entitled to. And so coming back to the grievance redressal mechanism under the law, I think the law envisages grievance redressal at two levels. One is, the first level is you can approach the entity you are aggrieved by directly. So you can file, every entity is required to appoint an officer, a data protection officer or any other officer to look into complaints by users under the Data Protection Act. So you can first approach them. If you're not satisfied with how the company has dealt with your complaint, or if they don't deal with it at all, you are of course also entitled to file a complaint before the Data Protection Authority itself. And the Data Protection Authority has a wide range of sort of directions it can issue. So from anything to a warning and a reprimand to a direction that an entity change its business practices and bring them in compliance with the act, to also imposing financial penalties. There are sort of suite of powers that the Data Protection Authority can exercise.
Right. Now, moving on to another key aspect of the bill, which is to do with children's data. Some critics have said that laying down the age of consent for processing children's data as 18 years is too restrictive. How would you view the bill's approach to children's data and consent-related provisions for children?
Yeah, I think you're right in the sense that, so what the bill contemplates is that for all children below the age of 18, irrespective of what data is being collected and irrespective of the purpose for which this data is being collected, parental consent is required. I think this sort of blanket approach is quite destructive of children's agency and choice. I think, and it also, I mean, given that especially now in the last 2 years, we've seen schools go entirely online And so when children, of course, we know children legitimately use online services for information and education and entertainment purposes even, this use should not be so stifled, which requires sort of repeated granular parental consent. I think there are other ways to deal with this. First can be, of course, to lure this age of consent under the General Data Protection Regulation, which you referred to in the introduction. This age of consent is 16 years. Under the UK Data Protection Act, this age of consent is 13. So I think, but this might not be enough. I think in addition to maybe lowering the age a little bit, which recognizes that at least older children or teenagers are capable of exercising agency, this can also be coupled with additional compliance requirements. For example, the data audits or the impact assessments that we referred to. So entities which deal with children's data can be, you know, mandatorily required to sort of undergo these impact assessments or audits. I think that's my view on this. But you're absolutely right that it does seem to be too restrictive and I think a little unnecessary.
Okay. Let's. I mean, we can only hope that better sense prevail on this front. And finally, on the question of regulating social media platforms and digital publishers, where does the bill stand? Because there's recently been a lot of controversy where there's been talk of classifying social media platforms as publishers and, you know, responsible for the content which comes out. So what does the bill have to say in terms of regulating social media platforms?
Right. This was, again, a very, very surprising recommendation by the Joint Parliamentary Committee. Of course, we haven't seen the final text of the report. But in essence, what it appears is that the Joint Parliamentary Committee has recommended that for social media platforms who fail to mandatorily verify their users, they will lose their status as an intermediary and be treated as publishers of content. I mean, let's look at both aspects of this recommendation. First is the mandatory user verification. This in itself is quite contrary to the objective of privacy or data protection, right? I mean, anonymity on the internet might be very important depending on who you are. If you are a whistleblower or a dissident or someone from generally from the marginalized section of society, anonymity on the internet might be the only way for you to be able to openly express your views. And the 2019 draft did not have anything in the bill about mandatory verification of users. So it's unclear where the authority has even sort of why the authority thought this was required. The second part of the recommendation, which is to treat social media platforms as publishers, again, to my mind, has nothing or little to do with data protection. The idea, I mean, essentially under law, so certain social media intermediaries are treated as intermediaries and not publishers of content, because on the assumption or on the logic, they act as conduits or main, and basically it's the users themselves who are liable for the content that they publish. And to make them responsible for content or to make them publishers of content, to my mind, is something which is addressed at maybe addressing hate speech issues or incitement to violence or some, you know, those harms. So those which of course need to be addressed. But I don't think the Data Protection Act is the forum or the appropriate legislation for these concerns to be addressed. The intermediary regime is a part of the IT Act, rules framed under the IT Act. So if any exceptions or any changes had to be made to this regime, it should have ideally been done as an amendment to those rules under the IT Act, following, you know, consultations on these issues. To try and do it through the back door under a data protection law, it seems to be quite incongruous to me, at least.
Right. There seems to be a bit of a confusing up of issues that sort of should come under the IT Act with the Data Protection Bill. And we'll have to see if this gets cleared up when the bill is debated in Parliament. We're running out of time. So one final question before we wind up. So many people have, sort of broadly speaking, expressed concern that the bill with its architecture of exemptions sort of lays the foundation not so much for data protection as for creation of a modern surveillance state. Is this really an overblown kind of a fear, or is there some justification to it?
I think I stand somewhere in the middle on this, and I'll tell you why. I think the bill was never intended, or actually it could not have brought about surveillance reform. The surveillance regime in India is contained under rules framed under the Telegraph Act or the Information Technology Act. This is a regime which is quite outdated and is in need of serious reform. So, for example, there are issues about there being no requirement of judicial or a prior judicial authorization for interception of communication or surveillance. Even the post-facto review mechanism consists or is controlled entirely by the executive. So these are certain sort of structural inadequacies which this bill, I think, could not have addressed. But having said that, I think it is definitely very, very troubling. These sort of broad exemptions that we talked about are very, very troubling, because it was expected that this bill would at least bring in one additional layer of safeguards or checks and balances as far as states' use of personal data was concerned. And so when we look at these broadly worded exemptions, it is quite disheartening to see that instead of providing greater control over data which the state handles, the state has allowed itself a complete free pass under the draft law. And that's why, the refusal of the JPC also to engage with this issue is so disappointing. And I think I'll borrow from Mr. Manish Tiwari's dissent note as it's been sort of published in news reports. The bill does seem to sort of create a parallel regime. It seems that a different regime applies to the private sector and a different regime applies to the state. And that was never the intention of this bill. So I think that's definitely a huge problem with this bill. But having said that, it could not have been the solution to all our surveillance problems legal surveillance issues in India.
Right. I think the excerpt from the dissent note you just read out, I think it sort of zeroes in on the fundamental problem here, which is of two parallel regimes of data protection, one for the private sector and one for the government. And I think it also sort of points to the fact that there seems to be an underlying mindset that a citizen's right to privacy doesn't really apply when it comes to the government. It only applies to the private sector. And I think this also comes through in some of the provisions that we discussed briefly. Just to quickly sum up, for instance, the sort of blanket exemptions which come from Clause 35 and Clause 12. And then the fact that the DPA is going to be appointed by the executive and membered with executive representatives. And also the fact that the government can issue binding restrictions on the data protection authority. And this entire business that if it's a matter of policy, then the executive is going to have the last word regardless of whatever the issue is. We've seen this in the Supreme Court as well. It's a matter of policy, so you please get out of the way. So we seem to have the same kind of mindset coming in here as well. So thank you so much, Kritika, for sharing your insights and comments on this very important legislation. I think it'll be very interesting to see how this plays out in the winter session. Thank you so much. Pleasure talking to you.
Thanks so much, Sampath. Thank you so much for having me.